Vodka O'Clock.
Good evening, everyone. It's Vodka O'Clock, and I'm Amber Love from AmberUnmasked.com. Just a reminder, we are labeled as an explicit podcast and website. So joining me today is Steve Wang, a creature creator, special effects artist, and film director who has worked with the biggest groundbreaking studios in the business, from Stan Winston to Rick Baker. He's worked on some of my favorite movies, like Predator and Hellboy and Underworld and Beetlejuice and these amazing franchises. So, Steve, welcome to Vodka O'Clock.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, this was such a great opportunity to get to talk to you. It's probably going to be a little harder for the listeners because you think of creature effects like really needing the visuals, but we will do what we can.
You can just post links to my Facebook page and they can see all the crazy stuff I have on there, too.
Yeah, you have some great sculptures, and like some of the statues are just massive. Like I can't believe how giant they are. So, according to Wikipedia, it said that you moved from Taiwan to the U.S. when you were 9 years old. So who joined you when you made such a big move like that?
Actually, I came with my family. My father was already here. This was 1975 when I moved here. And my father was already here with his brothers about a year before, I think. And then when everything was all set, my whole family just kind of got on the plane and we came over.
So did you find that being young for a move that was into such a different kind of place, do you find that being young was easier or harder to adjust to that?
Oh, it was definitely easier. But I mean, you know, it was for sure it was a culture shock. Coming from Taiwan, it's completely different over there. So when I came here and lived in, you know, suburbia, I've never seen so much space that was so spread out. Because where I live, you know, it was out in the countryside, but it was still... there was still kind of city everywhere, and everything was so compact compared to I moved to San Jose, California. So, but you know, I took to it instantly. I mean, I loved it when I first moved here, and my first day of school, I didn't speak any English except three words, which was "I don't know." And oh. Anybody talk to me, I just say "I don't know." So they asked me what my name was, I say "I don't know." But within one school year of sitting in a private class with a bunch of other students that were the problem students, I just read these cue cards all day long, like, you know, for the entire school year. And within one school year, I spoke pretty fluent English, so it worked out well for me.
That's really remarkable. They always say that kids pick up things easier.
Yeah, I can't imagine trying to learn another language as an adult. I'm sure it's very difficult.
So, with your family, did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have two brothers and three sisters. We're a pretty big family. Like, if we're the Brady Bunch, I would be Peter.
So, is anybody else in the family an artist?
Well, my youngest brother, Mike, he plays some instruments, like saxophone, keyboards. He's also a commercial director, and him and I actually produced a TV show together about 3-4 years ago called Kamen Rider Dragon Knight. And that aired on national television, Saturday morning television, for the whole year of 2009, I think, 2010. So, yeah, he's also in the film business. And that's it. Everybody else, no one else is in the film business or anything artistic. My son is he's an artist too. Actually, he's 20 years old now, and he's a sophomore in college. He goes to Otis College of Art and Design, and he's quite talented.
So, did you always have art in your life, or was it something that came to you at a particular time?
I started drawing since I was 4 years old, and it was funny because my older brother, who's not an artist, he started drawing when I was four, and seeing him draw made me interested in drawing. And he stopped soon after, and I never did. And I always had a fascination with you know, anything fantasy, science fiction, and masks in particular. But in Taiwan, as a kid, the masks that they had were just printed on cardboard with cutout holes. And so I was never exposed to, like, full latex over-the-head masks until I came to the United States. And when I came, it was around close to Halloween time, and I went to the first toy store and saw these things, and it blew me away. I was so amazed at the quality of these masks that I started collecting them, And by the time I was age 14, I collected 30 of them already. Just bought off my allowances and for chores that I've done, you know, stuff like that. And around that time is when I decided, you know, I really want to know how this stuff is made. I have an interest in it. You know, movies like The Howling and American Werewolf and The Thing was just starting to, you know, hasn't started coming out yet, but a lot of the movies were starting to gear towards special makeup. And that's when I realized, okay, you have to sculpt, you have to make molds. And there was not a whole lot of information back in those days. So anything I found out was through books about theatrical makeup, or sometimes Famous Monster or Starlog would have, you know, some, or Cinemagic would have some tutorials on how to do stuff. So basically I was self-taught on how to do all this stuff.
Well, I think it has really come a long way to a consumer level, because we had those paper masks with the holes punched up eyes too. And the latex ones, I don't think I ever had one. I remember my brother having a real scary one, though.
Yeah.
And
they're so magical, especially when you're a kid.
Yeah. And then things happen, like when I think about the horror movies that have become legends, like Scream and, you know, the Freddy and Jason and all of these things where the makeup effects and the costumes are such key elements to the storytelling. Immediately that stuff has like then become, you know, down to a consumer level where anybody can go and get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, especially now in the digital age, you know, internet, I wish I had the internet when I was a kid. 'Cause now, you know, I get emails all the time from people wanting to learn this stuff, and they say, hey, you know, how do you make this? How do you make that? And I'm like, seriously, YouTube. Go on YouTube. Everything you want to learn is on YouTube. You know, when I was a kid, I had to go to the library and try to find stuff, and there was just nothing out there. That was really hard to learn when I was a kid because there was no schools that I knew of, and, you know, so I learned through trial and error. It took a much longer time to learn than it would have if I had YouTube as a kid.
Right. I know some of the tutorials are done by SmoothOn, which is one of the product manufacturers. They make the raw materials.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's websites like Instructables and, you know, like you said, sometimes it's probably a little overwhelming for them to figure out how to learn to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that.
I wish they could teach it more in art schools.
Yeah, I think the problem with makeup effects now is that, you know, with the advent of computer technology, so much of what we used to do is being replaced by that. That, you know, people a lot of times when they ask me for advice, they say, oh, you know, I really want to get into makeup effects, and what advice would you give me? And I always feel like the bad guy, you know, the bearer of the bad news, and say, you know, our industry is dying, and there's hardly any work out here, and people are struggling who've been in the business a long time. And I try to advise them, like, if you really want to do it anyway, but don't count on it as something that you can do for a living. If you're lucky enough, you might be able to do it, but, you know, don't invest your whole life into it because it's treacherous out here now. It's so difficult, and especially for even people who've been in the business all their life. So, you know, it's, I just think that overall, I don't know. I just think that people just need to know, at least if you're going to invest all this money into schools and stuff, at least invest in something that's more viable as a career than makeup effects. It's hurting out here right now.
Yeah, so studying the CGI instead.
Well, you know, even that now, I don't know if you've heard recently, but companies like Digital Domain has gone bankrupt, and Rhythm and Hues have filed for Chapter 11. All the big companies now are closing down because they simply just can't afford to do it at the prices the studio wants. So what happened now is that a lot of the visual effects, which people aren't really aware of, you know, companies like ILM, they have alliances out in China, in Taiwan, you know, in different countries that can outsource shots to, that can do it for much cheaper. So whereas, you know, a few years ago, the CGI industry was booming, people were going to school, there was an influx of talent out there. Now there's a surplus, and it's horrible now, even for them, for that industry. So I don't know where this is all going, but I know it's not staying here.
So did you ever consider doing something then besides the creature work?
Well, you know, I sort of have. You know, even back when I was doing creature effects in the early 2000s, I started meeting video game companies like Blizzard Entertainment and who were fans of the stuff that I was doing. And so I worked with them maybe once every couple of years. I'll make some kind of a realistic display of their characters for them for trade shows. And that sort of, I was glad I did that because over the years, I started doing more and more and sort of became known for doing those kind of high-end statues. And now, this last couple of years, that's mostly all I do now is these realistic statues with the game companies. And I love that because, you know, as a kid, I wasn't really interested in makeup effects. It was just sort of, I love masks, I love monsters, you know, and the makeup effects part just sort of kind of fell into what I was interested in. So I ended up doing that quite a bit. But what my first love was always, you know, Halloween masks and making displays, statues, characters, you know, that you can display. So I've kind of come full circle now. I'm getting hired to do those things for the game companies. And so that's mostly what I do now, and it's been keeping, you know, my business afloat. And I still do movies when they come through. Like I just did one, Beauty and the Beast, that's being directed by Christoph Gantz. They just wrapped this week. It's being shot in Berlin. So we did that film, and then we're gearing up to do another film in the next week or two. So, you know, when they come through, we do them, but they're not our main focus anymore because, you know, the work just isn't there compared to other aspects. You know, first and foremost, I'm an artist. So now, you know, I'm putting myself out there, like, I can do bronze statues, I can do this, I can do that. Anything that requires our skill set, we can do. And that's kind of mostly what we've been doing now.
But did you ever think to yourself, I should have gone to law school?
No, not at all. Never. I'm a firm believer, you know, since I was a kid, that if you're not doing what you love, you're never going to be happy. And having that, growing up in an Asian family and having that mentality really kind of made me the black sheep of the family, because traditionally in an Asian family, what's important is, you know, when you grow up to have a good job, whether it's a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer, those are like the top three. And then when I told my parents I wanted to be a monster maker, I wanted to be a makeup artist, I wanted to make masks, they thought I was crazy. And so they, you know, my siblings, you know, not so much my sibling, like my older brother, he used to kind of joke around with me a lot and kind of make fun of me. Like, you know, here's my brother, he's the loser of the family. Because none of them really understood what is it that I wanted to do and how viable the business it was until I just say, well, I'm done with high school, I'm moving down to L.A., and within the first week I came to L.A., I got a job at Stan Winston's, and from that point on, things just you know, just rolling, and I was working a lot and made good money. And then at one point, my mom was having financial troubles with her business, and I gave her a ton of money, and that's when she realized, wow, you're actually, like, making real money. I'm like, yeah, and I love what I do. And so since then, they've been very supportive, but I had to prove it to them that it was a viable thing, a career that I have, you know.
I can't even imagine, what was it like to spend your days in Stan Winston's studio?
Well, you know, it's cool. Stan was really, of all the people I've worked with, all the old masters, Stan was really the closest thing to a mentor I ever had. You know, he really gave me a lot of opportunities. Like, when we were doing Monster Squad, I was hired because I came in with a portfolio and I showed him stuff he'd never seen before. And I'd only been in the business for a year at that point. You know, I was 20 years old. And so he hired me and my partner, Matt Rose, who also came down from San Jose, to head up the Creature from the Black Lagoon. And we're like, you know, two 20-year-old kids with 1 year of experience in the business. And we innovated this whole, you know, monster suit technology that's still being utilized to this day. And just him having the trust in us to do something like that. And then after that, gave me Predator to head up and do. You know, and Stan was extremely supportive. I mean, Stan taught me so many lessons in life, and one of the most important lessons that he had taught me was we were down in Mexico on Predator, and, you know, it's a crazy build. We had 8 weeks to build everything, and I didn't sleep for like 3 days at a time, and we got it done. We were down there, and I wasn't entirely happy with everything we did because there just was no time. And Stan came up after one day of shooting. He says, "Why? You know, I just want to tell you, you know, you did a great job on this." And I just went off like, you know, "Ah, oh, but I wish I had more time to do this, and this is wrong, and I wish I had, you know." And Stan just stopped me, and he says, "You know, you really need to stop sometimes and just take in everything you've done. And just, if you think you've done a good job, you should just enjoy it. Just, you know, take the compliment, feel good about your work, and then move on and do and keep doing, you know, and keep building from there. Appreciate what you've done." And I realized that I had never done that before. I was always like the self-hating perfectionist, and nothing's perfect, everything sucks, and I got to do it better next time because I'm a hack, and, you know. And so Stan taught me that, and that really resonated with me, because then when I started to appreciate what I was doing more, I felt that I was actually growing artistically and more creatively, because I didn't feel that pressure of having to be perfect anymore, you know. And I've always adapted James Cameron's saying, you know, with James Cameron says he's not a perfectionist, he's a greatest. It doesn't have to be perfect, it just has to be great. And I was like, yeah, that works for me. So it took, by taking the pressure off, I think you're allowed to be a better artist, because you're not afraid to experiment, to try things, and you're not afraid to fail. The fear of failure is what keeps most people from developing to their full potential, I believe.
Is that the same advice that as a father you give to your kids?
Oh, absolutely. My kids are amazing. They're my son and my daughter. They're what amazed me was that, you know, when I talked to them, I never realized how much they actually listened to me when I talk, because they start to tell me things about what they do, and I'm like, "Wow, where did you learn this?" And they're like, "We learned it from you." And, you know, I'm just like, that's amazing that they paid attention, because I teach them. I don't cry over spilled milk, you know. Like in a lot of families, when a kid spills some milk on the table, they start crying because they're afraid of the consequences that's to come. When my kids spill milk or they break the glass, we don't react at all. It's like, "Oh, clean it up." You know, it's just like I don't put any value behind that kind of environment. It's not nurturing. It doesn't allow a child to expand their mind and to you know, I teach them don't afraid to fail. You'll never do anything great if you don't take chances, you know, and you have to believe in what you're doing, and you have to just do your best. And at the end of the day, you failed. You know what? You didn't. You learned an amazing lesson in life. And that's really resonated with them, and they're very well adapted, and they're, you know, wonderful kids.
Well, since you were told that lesson so young yourself, because I consider, you know, early 20s pretty young.
Oh, yeah.
Did you really grasp that concept, or did you still ever go through periods where you felt like quitting?
No, I've never ever felt like quitting. I was, because see, this is how it works in our business, and it's become a parody now, you know, where a company will come up to you and say, "Hey, okay, we want you to build this thing, and this has never been done before, and, you know, do you think you can do it?" And we always say yes, no matter what it is. We always say yes. And then when they say, "Great," you know, and they give us the money, then we're like, "Oh, my God, how are we going to do this?" And that's where we grow as artists, you know. Then we figure it out. We always figure it out, no matter what. Every job that I've done, you know, I can guarantee you probably about 75% of what I do all the time, even to this day, are stuff I've never done before. And, you know, and so a lot of time it's my job to figure it out. And that to me is exciting. It's always scary no matter what. You're always going to be afraid, like, "Oh, crap, you know, and there's not enough time to figure this out. How am I going to do it?" But then the other half of me is like, "Hell yeah, let's get down. Let's do it. Let's learn. Let's learn something, you know?"
I can't even imagine with some of the fact that there's not just makeup, you know, applied to a human body, but there's the armor and all of that articulation that you need to be able to make sure that when you are dealing with actors inside there, that they need to be able to move. They need some comfort level.
Yeah.
Because I know that, like, for example, like the Iron Man suit, that it got to a point, I guess, where they had to CG a lot of that, mm-hmm. because it just wasn't working to mm-hmm. keep, you know, Robert Downey Jr. at a particular comfort level.
Right.
And then I've seen the behind the scenes stuff of like Hellboy.
Mm-hmm.
But 2 o'clock in the morning and you're getting him in the chair. It's like four something, however many hours of makeup applications. And, you know, anytime I've heard an interview with Ron Perlman, he's just happy to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and trust me, that guy's gone through hell. That guy's probably more makeup than any single person on this planet in terms of makeup days, you know?
Yeah, being the Beast from the 80s and
yeah,
that cowboy.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, he has bad days like everyone else. I mean, sometimes you sit there, you're just like, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. And then there's days you come in, it's like, all right, let's come on, put this on, let's go out and kick ass. You know, everybody has their days, but that man is very patient and he's amazing behind makeup. He has this amazing ability to bring characters to life. You know, like Doug Jones, another one, the guy who played Abe Sapien. He's the same thing. He's one of the most amazing, patient actors I've ever worked with. And he understands the process of makeup so well that sometimes when we're applying makeup on his arm, as we're applying it, he'll just kind of move his arm so that we don't have to move to assist us to apply it, you know. It's great, you know. And I think it all boils down to one simple concept, I believe, and that is you learn to appreciate what you have. You know, you appreciate the opportunity, you appreciate just what an amazing situation that you're in. And as long as you don't forget that, as long as you don't get complacent with what you're doing and what you have, it can be you can live an amazing life, a very fulfilling life, you know, creative life.
Well, thinking about movies like Hellboy and Predator, and I know that you said that today you were in meetings all day.
Mm-hmm.
So now that you've been in the business for 20 years, has your schedule gotten easier to handle?
No. it's kind of tough. I mean, for the longest time, people were always asking me, oh, why haven't you started your own shop? You know, why are you working as an art director for all these shops and doing all the work for them? You know, shouldn't you do it for yourself? You can make more money. You could do whatever. My reasoning has always been very simple. It's that if I run my own business, I won't have the opportunity to do the work myself, because I'm too busy running a business, you know. And that was the only reason why I didn't do it for the longest time, because when I go art direct for shops like Spectral Motion or Patrick Zatopoulos, you know, I go in there, I can work on the schedule and whatever, but also the condition is always I'm the frontline soldier. I want to be out there. I want to make this stuff myself. You know, I want to have a crew working with me, and we're going to build everything. It's all hands-on for me. So that's where I get the most fulfillment. Eventually, I started, you know, breaking away, and then realized, you know, I need to get my own business now, and because the industry is changing, and I'm moving out of the film industry a little bit more, and creating my own niche with this whole video game company statues we're making. So, at the beginning, when I got into that, I got in and did all the work, and I was just doing, you know, averages. If people were doing 8-hour days, I was doing 12, 16-hour days, and after years of that, you just realize, wow, you know, there's got to be a balance there. And the balance is I have to do less work on the floor and more in the administrative end, because somebody has to do, you know, has to keep the business running and has to meet clients, has to do this, has to do that, just to keep the business thriving. So I split my chores between that, and now it's come to the point. I just formed a new company with my longtime friend and partner, Eddie Yang. Our new studio is called Alliance Studio, whereas Eddie, he's had a lot of experience in the digital world, and I've been also in the practical world. Now we combine our resources and our talents, and now we're a full solution for the studios. You know, we can do concept designs to actual digital builds to actual physical builds, just basically anything, one-stop shop. Having done that now and having to even do more meetings and take on more, you know, side jobs and this and that, it's become even more difficult. So I just accepted that my days are going to be long, and if I want to do any artwork, I have to do it after everybody's gone and left for the day. I can stay late in the shop and work. It seems like a sacrifice, but it's not bad, because I'm getting to do what I love. So, you know, I think it all works out in the end, but you just have to work a lot harder.
Well, I know that you've also gone to some of the conventions like the monster shows and Comic-Con. So what has your reaction been when you see cosplayers, that these are just, you know, folks that put together these amazing outfits right in their homes and their garages and everything. That's something that you've helped design and you've helped just bring to the franchise, and all of a sudden there's somebody just who's a fan and wants to be that.
Oh, I think it's wonderful. I mean, I think probably the most prominent cosplay character that I'm exposed to, probably on a daily level because I get tagged on Facebook so much, is the Predator. There's a whole culture of Predator cosplayers, you know.
They're amazing.
Yeah, from like the Hunter's Lair, you know, it's a huge costume for them. And there are just so many members there. And some of the costumes they make are amazing, you know. I've seen a lot that were definitely movie quality. And they're just so obsessed with the Predator. And where, you know, they'll ask me questions like, oh, on this corner here, the Predator, is this? And I'm like, I'm sorry, guys. I worked on Predator for a total of 3 months about 25 years ago. And I don't live Predator. I don't breathe Predator. I don't, you know, that was just one job I did out of many that took off, you know, and really helped my career. And I'm really appreciative of it. But I don't know the Predator as much as you guys know the Predator, to be honest with you, because you guys study every inch of that thing. And I built it once, like 25 years ago. So I find that to be really funny because they think that I know every corner, every inch of it. But in reality, they know the Predator better than I do. That's the irony of it all. But I think it's great. I mean, you know, it's having been, you know, growing up as a kid and loving, like, you know, Ultraman, loving Frankenstein, the Creature from the Black Lagoon, you know, and having all those movies really influenced me as a kid and sort of helped shape my career. I think it's great to kind of pay it forward and be involved in creating something so iconic that has influenced and inspired so many other people of this generation. So, you know, I think that's just the way, you know, I think human civilization works, I guess. You know, we just, each generation inspires the next generation, and we just keep it flowing. So it's all great.
Yeah, and I mean, when you think about folks, like my costume, get into like, you know, a few $100s.
Mm-hmm.
But when I think about people that put thousands of dollars into something that they're wearing to conventions, and, you know, and I understand we do a lot of charity work and everything, but the Batman latex suits,
mm-hmm.
like you're saying, Predator.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money put in.
Yeah, and some of them are really, really good. They're very well made. You know, these people could be working in the film industry. I think the only difference with that would be just they would just have to have the discipline that they're probably not used to, because when you work in your garage and your spare time after work, it's very different. They're probably not used to showing up to work and having this amount of work to do and have to figure it out very quickly, get it all done and done right, you know. But certainly they're talented enough to just doing that wouldn't be a problem. It's just a matter of just doing it and getting into the groove of it.
As an art director on any of the franchises, have you really felt like you needed to hold your ground with something, like when perhaps like a director didn't design or had a problem with something?
Oh yeah, all the time. You know, I've been on shows where I've worked for art directors that were just very agreeable with the director. Anything the director wants, they get. I'm not that kind of art director. I tell them right off the bat, you know, you hired me for my vision, for my eye. And anything I don't agree with or anything I think is going to be a bad idea, it's going to be my job to tell you. And, you know, so I'm just letting you know right for day one, I'm not going to be your favorite guy. But at least you'll know at the end of the day that I've made an effort to help you obtain the best result that, you know, that you're trying to do. So, you know, a lot of times people will say, oh, I love this, I love that. I'll just say, well, you know, I think this is cool, but what about this? What about that? You know, would this make sense if you did this way? How about this? You know, it's all, for me, the art of doing creatures, the art of doing characters, it's all about storytelling. Everything we do is very theatrical. You know, we don't sculpt things to be totally realistic to the eye. We exaggerate it 10-20% because, you know, it has to read on film in a very different way. So I take all that into consideration. Like when I work on a character, I don't just go, oh, it's a robot, I'm designing a robot. It's like, oh, if it's a robot, I try to find out what's the story. Why is it, you know, even if it's not in the script, why is he the way he is? What's his background? Let's make him a background for him, you know. Who's the guy that made him and what was available to him and what kind of resources? You know, there's all these things that once you do it right, you know, you look at a character, you can look at it and it'll tell a whole story without having to say a word. So these are all sort of important things that I keep in mind as a creature designer you know, to aid me in doing the kind of work that I do.
What's the difference in process when you have something that already had a visual presentation like Hellboy that came from comics,
mm-hmm.
something like Predator, which had prose descriptions? Was there, you know, did you, because of, you know, Mike Mignola already had a vision, was that harder? Say, I need to make sure that it's exactly like this.
Well, I didn't build the Hellboy makeup per se. My good friend Matt Rose did the original one for the first movie. And, you know, he stayed pretty faithful to the overall design. But what he did was he took advantage of Ron Perlman's face, because Ron already has such an amazing face for that makeup. And he just kind of did it to bring out the best of Ron's face and still keep within the design of the Hellboy. At least that's what I saw when I saw his work. I was more in charge of Abe Sapien, doing Abe Sapien. And Abe Sapien in the comic compared to the final makeup is very different. In fact, from the concept design, they had a bunch of concept designers from the production side do sketches. I did some sketches. Jose Fernandez, who's another brilliant, amazing sculptor, he did a maquette that ultimately Guillermo del Toro really loved. And so that maquette was given to me, and I took that and I translated that into the makeup, so to speak. So I had to make a few more changes as I went to sort of suit how it fits the actor and, you know, my own kind of personal sensibility. And then I designed the paint job to go with it and how it all comes together. It was a very collaborative effort, but on a character like that, I think it was easier because, you know, he's a living, breathing fish man. So there was a lot of sort of, you know, as I went to Guillermo and explained things to him about how I wanted to approach things, you know, I had a lot of sort of ammunition, like why it needs to be this way. One thing in particular was, you know, Guillermo keeps saying to me, I want Abe Sapien to be bone dry. You know, I don't want any moisture on him. I don't want anything like that. And I didn't think that make any sense. You know, I think, well, he's a fish guy out of water. You know, fish is a very moist, wet kind of character. Why would they be bone dry? And I think it ultimately came down to the DP don't like to light anything glossy. And I say, well, that's cool, but, you know, it doesn't make any sense. You have to go, you know. And so what I did was when I did the makeup, I put this sheen on him, and I proved to Guillermo, like, here's without sheen. Here's with the sheen. See how much better and more realistic and lifelike it looks. And, of course, Guillermo saw it, and he agreed, and that's what we went with. So a lot of times we just have to prove our point, you know, to the director and say, this is what we want to do with it, and here's why. And if it makes sense to them, a lot of times they'll go with it.
Well, one of the things that happens in when we're talking about taking comics and translating them into movies is we do see changes, and the most recent one that's coming up will be the Superman outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's no longer going to have the red underwear on the outside that's been so iconic for so many decades.
Thank God.
You know, so when it changed in the comics, people said, oh, they're just doing that because of the movie. And mind you, there's like, you know, multiple titles and there's different, you know, it's comics. So there's, you know, there's probably like 17 Wolverine books and 5 Batman books. And so, you know, with Superman, there will always be opportunity to still see the version that a lot of us grew up with, the Christopher Reeve version.
Sure. And I can guarantee you this will not be the last Superman film ever made. or the last reinvention of Superman film ever made.
Exactly. So there's some sort of like advice and way that you can calm the fans down when this sort of change happens. Like, oh my God, Wonder Woman had pants and people flipped out.
No.
No,
there's no way to calm these people down. I've dealt with fans before. I actually executive produced a TV show called Kamen Rider Dragon Knight. It was a Saturday morning, you know, TV show adapted from a Japanese superhero show that was very iconic for Japan. The show's still going in Japan. And no matter what you do, no matter how great you think you've made it or what, there's always going to be some people that are absolutely going to adore it and some people that are absolutely going to hate it. So much so that they won't even watch your show because they hate the fact that it was even made. So you can't appease everybody. I think that's just the way it is, you know. And because of that, my personal feeling is like, well, screw it. You know, if you're going to do a film, do what you want to do with it. You know, dude, you know, I'm not a purist when it comes to comic books or even Star Wars. Like people, you know, I'm a big Star Wars fan, and I have friends like, how do you feel about Lucas, you know, bastardizing the Star Wars films and putting new CGI shots in it? I'm like, great, I want to see it. And they were like, that's blasphemy. How could you? I'm like, look, it's his film. You know, he obviously wasn't happy with the first go. He's getting a chance to do version 2, version 3, version 4, however many he wants to do. It's his right to do it. And besides, I've seen the version already, the original version. I want to see version 2 or version 3 and see what he does with it. I find that to be fascinating and interesting. I don't have to always like what he does, but, you know, the original version already exists, so what's the big deal? And I think the same goes with superhero designs, too. You know, sometimes they'll make a costume that looks amazing. Sometimes they'll make a costume that won't look so amazing. But it's not the end all. There's going to be other films. And you know, and I think if you deny people the chance to experiment, to try things, you're never gonna do anything creative. So, you know, Superman without the underwear, personally, Superman, the Christopher Reeve movie, that one, that's one of my all-time favorite films. I've seen that film over 100 times. At one time, I could even recite every single line of dialogue from that film, okay? Now, the new Superman without the underwear, I love it. Bring it on.
So great. It's so great to hear somebody excited who knows what the side is like.
Yeah, my partner, Eddie Yang, he actually modeled all the crest, you know, the belts, all the armor pieces on Superman. He actually did that for the actual film. So, you know, but that's not the reason why, you know, I design-wise, I think, yeah, it's Superman. But, you know, I'm more excited about what Zack Snyder is going to do with the franchise, you know. Like for instance, the difference between Christopher Nolan film, the Dark Knight films, versus the original series, you know, that Joel Schumacher and Tim Burton had done. They're completely different. But I love watching both versions because there's room for both.
Right, and even with the Superman changes, I mean Spider-Man changes from Sam Raimi to the recent one, I didn't think I was going to like that recent one, and I actually liked it so much.
Oh, me too. I love that film. I thought the new Spider-Man was great, you know, and I loved the original Spider-Man series too, and I thought that first Spider-Man costume was perfect. Like they nailed it. It was great. When I saw the images of the new Spider-Man, I wasn't so excited about it because I thought some of the stuff kind of bothered me, but you know what? When I watched the movie, that the suit never came up once in my mind as bothering me at all, because at that point it didn't matter. It served the film just fine, you know, and the characters were great, and the story was fun, and I felt like I was watching, you know, just a really engaging film. So, you know, in the end, to me, that's all that matters. The film engages you, you like the characters. A lot of stuff that may bother you probably won't bother you much at all.
It's really funny that you say that, because one of the biggest costume jokes in the superhero world anyway, the Batman nipples.
Yes.
And, you know, honestly, when I watched that movie, it didn't dawn on me one single bit until years later when I realized how many people made jokes about it.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't notice it.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because they didn't do it for the Batgirl, you know?
Right. Yeah, well, they're always photoshopping out nipples. Like, for Angelina Jolie, hasn't had nipples in, like, I don't know how.
Yeah, exactly. She probably doesn't have nipples in real life now.
So, do you have, because of your crazy, crazy schedules and stuff, and the fact that you're involved with the video games, do you have hobbies? Like, you sit down and play the games?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm a parent, so I have my kids. You know, I've been divorced for a while, but I see my kids just about every single weekend, and so I always make it a priority to spend time with my kids, even though they're kind of adults now. We're still very close, and then, you know, I spend time with my girlfriend. I think that's a good excuse for me to have to get out of the shop and get out in real life. And she's an artist too, so a lot of times she ends up working longer than me. Then I have to go and spend time with her when she's working. But as far as hobbies, I'm a gamer. I love playing video games. Not all games. I'm mostly into like first person shooters. Like Half-Life 2 is one of my all time favorites. Doom, you know, the Call of Duty series, you know. So anytime I get a free chance, I'll sit down and I'll play video games, even if it's just for 10 minutes, you know, at a time or whatever. But, you know, but as far as having a life, it's very hard, you know, in what I do because I am so busy. And I just try to find a balance there. And, you know, I was told once by somebody who read my palm that, oh, my lifeline and my work line is joined together and it's just one. And they said, are you a workaholic? And I go, I don't think so, but I suppose by other people's standard, I am. But for me, you know, I mean, I love what I do. And one of my...
You do is very different, so it might not feel quite like work all the time.
No, it's. I mean, I'm still just amazed that I'm getting paid to do what I do, you know, and I'm making a decent living at it. So, you know, again, one of my missions in life right now is that, you know, is that I want to do as much art, leave behind as much art before I die for people to enjoy. So to me, that's not really work. You know, that's my passion. That's what I want to do. So.
Well, one of the things that I find as like such a great fun hobby is pumpkin carving. And because I know that, you know, you said that how much you love Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered like what Halloween at your house must be like.
Sadly, Halloween is probably the worst holiday for me because I'm usually so busy. I don't have time for Halloween. I don't even have time to go to the parties anymore. I just, you know, it's hard. If I actually make it out to a Halloween party, it would be amazing. But I do love the holiday, and I love seeing kids trick or treat, even though they don't trick or treat much anymore in my neighborhood. It's kind of sad seeing all that. But again, you know, the thing that I love about is when we get to September and I go to like Party City or Walmart, whatever, and you start seeing all the Halloween decorations, the Halloween masks. If I see that, it makes me feel like a kid again, and so I love that.
That's pretty cool. Do you remember anything that you've dressed up as for Halloween?
I was Darth Maul once or twice, I think, years ago. One time I was the Matrix. Yes, the entire Matrix. No, actually, I dressed up as Neo or something like that because it was the easy costumes you could just put together literally overnight or something, you know. I rarely ever do any kind of makeups anymore or stuff like that because you need a lot of time to actually design and build and don't have time for that anymore. So, but I enjoy going out to the parties whenever I can and seeing all the cool stuff that everybody else is making.
So. I wondered if you, because you've done some, you know, acting as well and writing and everything, knowing what the actors have to go through for all of that makeup, you know, thinking about Abe Sapien and Hellboy, all those eye pieces and the makeup and the fur and everything. Did you ever go through that yourself so that you know what they're feeling like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, before I started applying makeup on actors, I was applying it on myself. You know, one of my first projects at age 14 was I built a full monster suit. And I entered a contest, and I stood behind stage for an hour and a half inside this suit, almost passed out from heat exhaustion. So I've had exposure to all this stuff very early as a kid, so I know exactly what they go through, and I know how to call their bullshit if they're just being difficult. They're like, what? I've done this before. I've slept in makeup. You know, I've been in it for 18 hours, and I slept in it from day two. You know, so I know what it's like. It's not as hard as some people might want to say that it is. What's harder for an actor, I think, is just to be sitting on set all day, not be used, and then come to the 11th hour. All right, we're gonna use you now. Perform. I mean, that's hard, you know.
Yeah.
So I appreciate what they do for sure. I mean, I've been on so many sets, and I've directed many actors before, you know, on my own movies and my own TV shows, and you know, they don't have a very easy job. I can say that.
So you mentioned that you just finished wrapping on New Beauty and the Beast. Now this a movie. This is not the CW show.
No, this is a full length feature. It's shot in it's a French movie. The director is Christophe Gans, who did Silent Hill and Brotherhood of the Wolves. He's a very, very good director, very visual director. And Patrick Tatopoulos actually was the designer on the show, and he brought me on to build the Beast. So we built that. We built a whole suit for him, you know, a fur suit. And then we designed the head of his face, what he would look like. and it's being done very similar to where the Wild Things are, where the faces are going to be digital. So we actually designed and built a face here, and we gave them assets to scan in Germany, and then based on the displays, you know, the reference pieces that we've made for them, they're going to match the character to our designs, but it'll perform like with the actor's own face. So they do a whole performance capture process with the actor, and Vincent Cassel plays the Beast. He's a great actor, so all his expressions will get translated onto the Beast's face, much like it was done in Avatar. So I'm very excited about it. I think all the stills that I've seen from set, everything just looks amazing, and the script's great. You know, it's a really charming script. It's not pretentious. It's not like a reboot, you know, with rock and roll music or something crazy like that. As far as I can tell, it's a nice modern telling of just a classic story, and it takes place as a period piece, and you know, it's going to be beautiful, and it's made for kids too. It's you know, it's a family film.
Oh, that's really exciting, because I know a lot of the fairy tales that's coming out now is all very dark, very like not rated R necessarily, but very PG-13.
Yeah. No, this movie's not dark at all. It's very charming, and it's you know, it's a love story between the Beast and Belle, and it's the script is great. It's so, you know, I have high hopes for it, because when I was reading it, I really felt a lot of emotions, you know, and I really kind of grew to like the character just from reading words on a page. So I know it's gonna be really cool.
That's good. Do you have any idea when it would be released?
I don't know. You know, they literally just wrapped this week.
Okay.
So, you know, usually when a film wraps, you have between, I don't know, six months to a year before it comes out. So sometimes, probably end of this year to early 2014, I would imagine.
All right. And are you going to be able to visit any conventions, like any of the Comic-Cons or monster shows?
Yeah, I'm planning to go to Monsterpalooza in Burbank in April. Not as a guest or anything. I just show up and I go and, you know, check out the shows, because I'm a big fan myself. And then I'm going to Comic-Con this year. I'll have a booth there with my partner at Toynami, the big Toynami booth. I have a new collectible company now called Elite Creature Collectibles. And we're going to be debuting our first few pieces there to show the general public. So we're getting to collectibles too, and it's very exciting. We just got the Blade franchise, and working on a couple of other really high-profile franchises too. So keep your ears peeled.
Yeah, that'll be great. Mm-hmm. Because I was thinking of, like, I know that there's like IMAX, like specifically for makeup arts and stuff, but they're not necessarily monster shows.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never been to the Comic-Con out in San Diego. I've only been to the ones on the East Coast, and I can't even imagine how, you know, thinking about getting those giant statues that you make and everything. Because I remember like a Hulk, how gigantic it was,
mm-hmm.
and you know that the Blizzard characters tend to be just larger than life to begin with, so the amount of space that something like that must take up.
They're really fun. You know, I love going to the shows and seeing people's reactions to the statues, because a lot of times the people at least at the video game conventions, you know, they already know these characters, and a lot of them are big fans of the characters. So to be able to walk up to one in real life, you know, and that looks realistic to them, I look at their expressions and I just crack up, because they're just so blown away by it. It's just great fun for us.
Well, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you the weirdest question I've probably ever asked. If one of the creatures came to life to kill you, what would be your ultimate death by creature?
Well, you know, being that I'm known for the Predator, I probably, you know, have to die by the hands of Predator if that was going to happen. You know, I think the Predator fans probably wouldn't want it any other way. Anyway, it would be a great honor to be killed by a Predator. But it's a very weird question, I will say.
And then who would save you? Who would you want to be able to save you?
Well, I guess it would have to be the Guyver.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the Guyver can definitely take on the Predator, no problem.
All right. Steve, did you want to share any of your website links while...
I have two website links. My new company with Eddie Yang is called alliancestudio.net. That's A-L-L-I-A-N-C-E, studio, singular, .net. Go check out our website. It's new. And then for those of you who want to see like just a crap ton of work that I've done over the years, they can go to my public Facebook page. And it's just facebook.com/Steve Wang Creature Creator. Check it out. You know, you can just, it's all the photos are public, so you can just, you know, get your fill of monsters, you know, all you want. So
thank you so much for all of your time, Steve. I know you're really busy.
Yeah, no, thank you for taking the time. It's been fun.
And a little shout out to Neil Vokes, who, right?
Yep, Neil's awesome.
Great. All right. Well, guys, we're going to let Steve go back to his crazy, exciting life over there in California. Don't forget that you can follow me at Elizabeth Amber on Twitter. And this is Amber Love from AmberUnmasked.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. Cheers.